KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Our whole concept is based on the technology of allowing people to use these cars when and how they want to.
Visual artists started to look at experience and performance as valid forms of art and art making.
We're going to get a team back here, and we're going to be just like we were in the 90s.
Hey, that introduced yesterday's show. Oh, technology. Once again, you've risen to smite us. Today on the program, we're going to talk in our studios right now with the University of Washington President Michael Young. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Garfield test boycott, and we're going to do a weekend weather forecast. That's all coming up. Washington's six public college presidents have a deal for the legislature. They said they'd hold back on tuition increases for 2 years. In return, the legislature would spend $225 million more on higher ed. I don't know that that's going to happen, but we'll find out. Michael Young is president of the University of Washington. He joins us. Good to see you again, sir.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Before I get into budgets and budget things, though, I told you that I just wanted to ask you to wax about the what interesting things you've seen at the UW. And by the way, I need to say up front as well that in the interest of full disclosure, the University of Washington is the license holder for KUOW, the self-sustaining service of the University of Washington, as you've heard us say. So that means ostensibly, you know, I work for you. But it's far removed. But in the interest of full disclosure, what interesting things have you run into?
A lot of terrific things happening at the university. We have had some remarkable scientific breakthroughs this year. People may not be entirely aware of this, but as we were sequencing the human genome over the past decade or so, there was about 25% of the human gene that people called sort of junk DNA, didn't know what it did, sort of the dark part of the DNA. A team led by our researchers discovered largely what the functions of that will be. It's a switching function, switches the protein, controls the protein and the protein's development. Remarkable breakthrough. Nature and Science, which are probably the two leading scientific magazines in the world, both listed it as one of the top 10 discoveries of the year. It's incredibly important. We also had a breakthrough where we researchers, actually led by two graduate students in one of our labs, in John Stander's lab, determined a way to figure out what the DNA sequence is of a fetus by taking the mother's blood and saliva from the father. There have been a whole series of really remarkable breakthroughs. We recently rolled out a whole series of articles. In fact, Lancet magazine, which is another one of the great scientific journals, devoted a triple issue to this work, which has never been done before, in which Chris Murray, through the Institute for Health Metrics, basically had been able to map health outcomes all over the world, which is a remarkable breakthrough because it allows us to ask the question, where do we put our healthcare dollars to have the greatest impact, not only globally but locally as well?
You know, I asked you that just to remind you and me and all of us that you don't do this just to crunch numbers. You do it because you like higher ed, you like the what's happening in learning. All those things you mentioned, though, were science and medical breakthroughs and investigations. Probably in schools that would not be as strong as they are, but for federal money, foundation money, and state money, but especially the federal dollars, right? I mean, a lot of what we have benefited from has been the federal government coming down to the state, seeing value investing in state institutions.
Well, it's been enormously important to the University of Washington. In fact, we get more federal research dollars than any other public university in the nation. In fact, we are second only to Johns Hopkins in overall extramural research funding, about $1.5 billion last year. And every one of those dollars goes to some sort of project of the sort I've described, but also draws in our students. I mean, one of the great things about being a research university is that we not only are able to make those scientific breakthroughs, but that whole era of discovery and pattern of discovery is part of the teaching process. So we had last year alone 6,000 of our undergraduates who were in the laboratories or working side by side with professors doing research projects. So they not only learn learn things, but they learn how to learn things. They learn how to create and discover.
As you look to the negotiations over federal spending over the next few months, what impact do you envision, or what would be the worst and the best outcomes realistically in terms of what they're looking at in terms of cuts for the university?
Well, the worst outcome, I think, is if there's any substantial cut to NIH or NSF funding, because that has been the bedrock of scientific discovery in America for 75 years. And one of the things that has kept America on the cutting edge of the world economy for that same period of time, a really kind of an unprecedented development in world history. And so substantial cuts there really has the potential in the medium and long term to really undermine the United States. Best case scenario, we think, is steady state. These are competitive grants. These are not pork barrel. These are determined by scientific committees who, you know, what projects are most promising and most worthy. We are very competitive in that regard, as I mentioned, really leading the nation in that competition. So it would be significant for the state, even as a sheer economic matter, if that declines, even in the very short term, because those dollars come from outside the state. They create jobs here in the state, as well as create innovation that creates breakthroughs, that create companies, that create jobs, that create other kinds of economic development. So a decline in that funding would be serious for the United States, serious for the university, and serious for the state of Washington. But we're cautiously optimistic of steady state in that regard.
Michael Young is president of the UW. You know, all right, so in terms of steady state, this is from June 2012. University gets puts all their information online here. So I'm looking at the operating budget, revenues, and expenditures by fund and category. Yeah. State general fund, change between fiscal year 12, fiscal year 13, you're looking at about a 1% decrease in state general fund money. Is that right? About, is that, how much money does that translate into? Is that $2 million?
That's about what we anticipate.
So that's almost steady state in a sense?
It is, although you have to put it in a little bit of perspective, which is over the past 4 years, it's a 52% decline in state funding. At the same time that we have a slightly larger student body, when you put all that together, we actually have considerably less money to devote to each student than we had 4 years ago.
And what's the solution you're proposing to that? What would you like to see the legislature consider?
Well, our proposal is we think it is untenable to continue to place the increasing burden of higher education on the students and their families, and that the state needs to reinvest, and if they'll make even modest reinvestments in the state, and that's what we're asking for, is a fairly modest reinvestment, we'll be able to ameliorate some of those tuition increases that we've been forced to over the past few years.
$53 million more in tuition operating revenue between FY12 and FY13.
That's right.
What do you expect? So it's a 12% increase over that year. What do you expect going forward if they didn't do the investments? And then I'm going to ask you about what kind of investments you're talking about.
Well, it's too early to say at this point. I mean, I think the one thing we are all committed to, and we work very closely with our students as we talk about where any additional tuition revenues would be deployed, but preserving the excellence of the institution is absolutely critical. We have a world-class faculty. Our students need that, and they deserve that. The state needs that and deserves that. And maintaining that faculty becomes absolutely imperative. And I think we would need to think about what we need to do to make sure we're able to do that. But we haven't really put any numbers on the table or thought really about exactly what it would look like.
But one of your concerns is that you're not paying a competitive salary. You're falling back in terms of salaries with other peer institutions?
Yeah, I think there's there's little doubt. There's a great deal of data that confirms that because, excuse me, no other major research university in the country has had the kind of cut in their budget that we've had. No other major research university in the country has come close to having this depth of a cut, and that is a concern, because preserving the excellence of this institution for our students and for the state is absolutely critical.
Well, are the six public college presidents working together to lobby the university at this point?
We are. We're very united in this notion that we all agree that for a modest reinvestment in each of our institutions that we can begin to work towards ameliorating the burden on our students.
What is that number, by the way, a modest reinvestment? What is it for the UW itself?
It would be in the neighborhood of about $85 million.
For this year?
For the biennium.
For the biennium starting, that starts?
That starts next fiscal year.
Yeah. What's been the response?
Well, it has done a couple of things. I mean, I think one is it has highlighted the relationship between the tuition increases and the decline in state funding. And that sometimes there's a sense that the university's costs are out of control and so forth. But the truth of the matter is we have one of the most efficient and effective systems of higher education in the country here in Washington. In addition, we have been able to demonstrate an enormous number of cost savings. But the problem has been when you lose half of your state funding, over $200 million over the past few years, there is some need to find ways to preserve that excellence on the student's behalf. That relationship is clarified, I think, by this request, that if the state will make that modest reinvestment, we won't have to go back to the tuition pool.
What are the private sector donors telling you? Because this is where you've turned in the past, and some people have said, oh, this is where you should get the money.
Donors have remained remarkably committed to the university and generous to the university. There's no doubt about that. They feel like, rightly in my judgment, that they want to partner with the state. That the University of Washington is a public good. It does enormous things on behalf and the benefit of the state, and they want to support that. They want to leverage up and be that margin of excellence, and they would like the state also to share in the building of these great institutions. So they haven't been – they haven't declined their funding, but they feel like we do, which is this is really a collaborative effort for the good of everyone.
So you know, like we all know, that the legislature and the Republicans who are taking over the state Senate are saying for now that they're holding to this. The McCleary decision, the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court said you're not amply funding K through 12 education. And some people are saying a billion. Some people are saying even more money over the next few years to get into that system. You know, you don't want to rob Peter to pay Paul, but what's your thoughts about how they should solve that problem?
Well, I mean, I would say a couple of things, I think. First, we really don't. We feel very strongly about not pitting the universities against other kinds of state needs. I mean, the quality of K through 12 is probably as important or more important to us than anyone else in the state.
I mean, haven't I heard you say you haven't been getting and you want to make sure you are going to get students in this state who don't need remedial classes when they come to the U?
Yeah, exactly. And we'd like that to continue. We have a terrific student body. Our applicant pool is up again pretty dramatically this year. And that's a product of public education. And so we care passionately about that. We provide more charitable health care in the four county region, for example, than anyone else, and we would, and so money given to social services and healthcare matters to us enormously as well. So we don't want to view ourselves as being pitted against any other part of the needs of the state. It's important. We're all in this together. But at the same time, I think sometimes the dialogue about McCleary has, I think, a remarkably 18th century cast to it. Because if you actually look historically, there have been various decisions saying, yes, the state has this constitutional obligation, but it's been defined by the legislature, and it initially was up to sixth grade and then up to eighth grade, and now K through 12. But in fact, in this era, it really is preschool. It's sort of 3 to 23. It's preschool all. It's K through 16 at least, if not preschool as well. The need for education, post-secondary education, is as pressing as high-quality public education at the pre-secondary level.
All right. Well, I see how you're rolling it all together. So let me take a break, and when I come back, I'm going to ask again if you think that I know you've been asked this before. what you say to Governor-elect Inslee about those prospects when he said no new taxes. So we're talking with University of Washington President Michael Young. We'll take a break. This is Weekday.
Dubs up. Yeah. Dogs in the house. Let me hear your bark. Let me see your bite. Let me see your scar. You know what we about.
31 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Forecast says it's going to be sunny all day with a high of 39. Mark Linus is an author, journalist, and environmental activist. He used to be an outspoken opponent of genetically modified foods, but now he feels differently. He says genetically modified foods are a good thing. We'll find out what changed his mind today at noon.
Support for KUOW comes from Amgen, advancing science education and recognizing the contributions of Washington's science teachers through the Amgen Award for Science Teaching Excellence. The online application for teachers can be found under Corporate Citizenship at Amgen.com.
It's 9:21. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Are you ready for some football? Ahead of Sunday's big Seahawks game, we're going to talk with sports columnist Art Thiel. That's just 20 minutes away on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Michael Young is our guest. He's the president of the UW. How long have you been doing this job now?
About a year and a half.
A year and a half, yeah. Settled in?
Well, you know, I think so. I can get from my home to the office with only, you know, two wrong turns.
No plans to leave yet?
No plan. No, I love it here.
Because when you were first hired, I read an article that said, well, one of the things that could happen is Michael Young would just throw up his hands and say, I'm not doing this job because there's not enough money and leave.
Oh, it's an extraordinary institution. And I feel privileged to be here. And I very much enjoy the people I work with because it is a great institution that's just getting better.
All right. If the argument is that really education in this state, if it's to be adequately funded, needs to at least be funded pre-K to 23, so that people include higher education at that. There's $1 billion that people are talking about for K through 12. You just the University of Washington alone is looking at $85 million in this biennium, this next biennium. Nobody wants to broach the question of new revenues. Well, let me rephrase that. The governor-elect is not talking about new revenues. Republicans in the state Senate are not talking about new revenues, that the money can be found and that other places can be cut, I guess. It seems like it's a finite place. You got to shift money around. What do you say to that?
Well, I think in the end, there certainly has been some rhetoric about no new taxes, but even if you look at some of the business organizations, they have not been adamantly opposed to some variation of revenue enhancement. They want reform before revenue enhancement, and that, you know, that may make sense.
But, do you know what they mean by that?
I have some ideas, but I suspect I'll let them speak for themselves as to what kinds of reforms they really want. And some of those reforms may have themselves cost savings and revenue enhancement as well. But it suggests to me that there is some growing sense that we need a balanced approach to these problems, and that, you know, if not, maybe not this year, but the time's going to come when the realization, as I've sort of said before, that the world's stupidest tax system that we have here in the state does not sustain the world-class economy and the world-class society that we're trying to build here. And I think there is some growing sense that that there is a set of measures that do make sense across the board.
Across the aisle, that there's a sense that the same measures are you have talked to folks in all the camps who maybe mention the same reforms.
Look, I'm just a country lawyer. I don't pretend to understand all of the politics about it. But there have certainly been some people who are just adamant that there will be no new taxes and we'll continue with this tremendously regressive system we have and the way we've got it structured. But I'm pleasantly surprised at the number of people who think that a more rational tax system is possible it could generate some revenue enhancement in a very fair and balanced way, and that at least could be helpful, because our capacity to grow the institutions that we need to support the infrastructure that's essential, it just isn't there right now.
You know, you mentioned not wanting to put through more tuition increases, but you have had what's been the percentage of tuition increases over the last 4 years? It's been 70. You flipped the formula. Now it's 72% is coming from university, and therefore.
Well, that's the interesting part, is that it actually costs us in inflation-adjusted dollars a little less to educate a student today than it did 20 years ago. But 20 years ago, the state was paying about 80% of that money and the students 20%. Now the students are paying about 70% and the state is paying appreciably less than 30% of that.
So 70%, though, is coming from 70, tuition.
Yes. Although let me be clear and about fees. That as well. We've worked very hard to ensure that even with these tuition increases, we're able to help students get through. We continue to maintain the Husky Promise, and the only institution, I think, in the state that does, which basically says if you're from a certain income level, that we will guarantee between Pell Grants, state-based aid, and aid we put in, you won't pay any tuition or fees at all. And the state aid has been generous in the past, but 35,000 students last year who qualified for state aid didn't get it. Those who come to the University of Washington, we make up that difference. And the consequence of that is over half of our students, even with these increases in tuition, over half our students are leaving without any debt at all. And the half that are leaving with debt are leaving with about an average of about $20,000. The national average is about $27,000.
You have said that in terms of a deal for a student, that the University of Washington is still a good deal compared to peer institutions, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So given that, isn't there a little room yet to increase tuition again and use that increased money, as you have said, to help the most needy?
Well, it's possible, but we're very cautious about it because there's also a sense that people get a certain kind of sticker shock when they see it, and that the very size of that tuition will scare some people off from applying. It'll be precisely the people who would be most promising students and benefit the most from this kind of an opportunity. Over 30% of our entering class last year were first-generation college students, first in their family to ever go to school. And we are committed to that kind of diversity and that assurance that no matter what your situation is, if you are qualified and able to benefit from this education, we'll let you in and we'll figure out a way to get you help you get through. But I think while we could move to the kind of model that some of the private institutions move to, which is very high tuition and very robust financial aid, it is a model that works less well for certain people in certain income levels and people with less exposure to higher education.
The University of Washington is doing a lot of building, especially a lot of building on west of 15th off the main campus, new dorm rooms, new apartments. Some buildings have come down. Others are being replaced. They're very lovely, lovely black stone. Who are they for?
They're for our students. There's been tremendous demand. We consistently have had waiting lists for students who want to live on campus, have that kind of full, intense, engaged experience. And we are working very hard to provide that. Last year alone, 95% of our freshmen lived either in the dorms because we're able to build new dorms or in the Greeks. And we will have two more dorms coming online this year as well. They're really an important part, too, of the educational experience.
Are they higher-end apartment structures than typical dorms that are on campus? And do they cost more for a student?
I'm not sure I'd describe them as higher-end as much as I would describe them as differently configured, because one of the things that we've learned over the years is that you can configure the dorms with more open spaces, more spaces for students to gather and things like that really enhance the interaction of the students and the educational experience itself. And so they're differently configured.
They don't cost more than the older dorms that are on campus?
Well, sure, they cost more, but I think a lot of that's a function of construction costs.
For rent or for...
There is a differential for the new dorms as opposed to the old dorms.
Are they being built in order to house out-of-state and out-of-country students who can afford to pay more and then infuse the university with a little more cash?
No. Certainly our out-of-state and international students love to live in the dorms, but the vast majority of students in the dorms are actually Washington students, as are the vast majority of our students. I mean, the number of out-of-state students has not risen dramatically over the past 4 or 5 years.
So these dorms are paying for themselves, but not adding much to the university's bottom line.
That's right. Yeah. Basically, we're trying to ensure that we can recover costs and maintain the dorms, but these are not significant revenue generators of any sort.
You're building more dorms right up against University Bridge, right?
That's right.
What are those also the same thing? Just newer dorms, but
yes. Although one of the projects we're building is actually a project in collaboration with the Seattle Children's Hospital, where we're building moderate income housing for staff for the hospital. We're working with them to build that. So there's one project out there that's not actually a dorm project.
For the UW Medical School or for Children's?
For Children's.
Oh, so they'll be commuting a little bit?
Yes.
Awfully close to University Bridge. I don't think I'd want to be living in one of those.
Easy commute.
What are the university's plans more broadly for moving west?
We have a real interest in ensuring that is a lively, dynamic, vibrant part of the community, and the dorms are sort of a big part of that. So we've got a lot more people kind of living over there, engaging the businesses and so forth. So we're working closely with the business community over there, asking exactly those questions. What is thinking 5, 10, 15 years ahead? What should the development in that area look like? How can the university partner with the community to build things that really enhance the quality of that community, at the same time benefit the university? It's really kind of our front porch in a way, and so... it's important to us, and we have a very good, fairly intense dialogue going with the community.
It is your front porch, and if I might insert my bias here, which nobody wants, but I will anyways, why the university built parking structures in front of their water instead of doing that kind of grand concourse entrance that they had talked about years ago, I don't understand. It was before your time, but
It's one of those great things I can blame my predecessor.
You should indeed on that one, because why they have parking where they could have beautiful views. Are there plans for university programs and departments on the West? That used to be a big sticking point. People didn't want the university to expand west towards the I-5 bridge, but it's already doing it with the dorms and some programs. Are there more?
I don't know that there's a... that's partially what this dialogue is about, is what are the optimal uses that really create a vibrant, dynamic, livable community there with the kind of mix of housing and retail and business and so forth that's really optimal. At this point, I think it'd be premature to say there are any specific plans to do anything, but there's a really good discussion going on.
There are plans, of course, for South Lake Union, where the university is, I think, right now constructing another building. And, as you told me, plans for three more?
Well, we have footprint for three more, that's right.
Why be down there now, and what have you gained from having that proximity to, well, now it's Amazon, but also those life sciences that were initially moving in there?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening, and it's a good development, and I think in many ways this university is a poster child for this development, is more collaboration and integration with businesses that are the beneficiaries of the research that go on, or that themselves are doing research that is complementary to the work the university is doing. And so being co-located in some cases really creates a certain kind of synergy that expands that research in really powerful ways. And we're really seeing that down there. And, of course, the more space we have, the more research funding we can bring into the state. And the more researchers we can bring into the state, the better the educational opportunities and the more innovation and breakthroughs that occur.
Well, does that mean that those companies then are and those businesses are avenues by which you can offset the decreasing support from the state?
The research money isn't fungible. I can't take a federal research dollar and give it to a professor to teach class unless I want to spend my declining years in Sing Sing. I mean, there's sort of limits on what you can do in that regard. Research does relate, as I mentioned before, to the teaching in a really powerful and useful way, but it's not a substitute for state funding at all.
Do not go to Sing Sing. That would be that would not look good for anybody's resume. Well, then, all right, so then giving back, I'm circling back around. What if the bargain you were suggesting to the legislature was we won't raise tuition this next time. Give us the money we need, $250 million for all the universities. What's your stopgap? What's your plan B?
We're just so optimistic that the state will have the vision to realize the importance of higher education.
We don't need
a plan B.
That's right.
Were we to have a plan B, we're looking at all different revenue sources. We're working very hard with our donors, particularly on the scholarship side, to be able to provide funding for our students to ensure that they have opportunities. As we said, if that funding is available, we would be able to ameliorate these tuition increases. If it's not available, tuition is another possible source. Our hope would be, in any event, to keep it very, very modest. We would look for expanded revenue from our commercialization activities and other auxiliary activities. So looking for everything.
But I imagine you're doing that anyways.
We are doing all that.
Is that
as well as cost savings? I mean, we're doing an awful lot of work that is squeezing as much administrative efficiency out of the system as we possibly can, and looking for more efficient and effective ways to teach as well. These are not silver bullets. Technology, does not save the day. It enhances, I think, the quality of education. There's no real evidence it has substantial cost savings yet in it, but we're looking for those.
Immigrant advocates have say they're going to push for a bill in Olympia to give undocumented students access to higher ed grants and financial aid. Do you have a position on that?
Yes, I think it's a good idea. And I have supported this kind of thing for 7 years in Utah to ensure that that undocumented students could get in-state tuition. And the reason I believe it's important is because higher education allows someone to make, on average, a much more significant contribution financially and otherwise to society, and it unleashes that human potential. And for kids who are here in the United States through no sort of conscious choice of their own, who've been through the system, who have done everything to deserve these opportunities and demonstrate that they have the qualifications, capacity to make those kind of contributions to society, I don't think we are a rich enough society to waste that resource. Only really rich people can waste resources, and I just don't believe we are a rich enough society that we can waste the human capital that's out there.
The economy has gotten better, and has that had any effect on the needs of the university? Have you seen any way that the improvement in the economy has helped offset some of the burden you've taken on from seeing those state cuts over the last 4 years?
Probably not in a really dramatic way. I mean, we see some of our auxiliary operations, many of which are largely designed to be self-sustaining and not profit-making. They are doing a little better, but that doesn't feed an enormous amount of money back to the university.
And what about next year when the Affordable Care Act kicks in? Where is it going to help you, and where is it going to mean additional costs for you?
Well, it presumably helps in the sense that there are an awful lot more people insured. The challenge it presents...
What did I read? $100 million plus in uncompensated care from the UW?
Uh-huh.
Is that yearly?
That's annual. And that goes up as the economy goes down. So that may be one area where we'd see the economy help us a little bit in reducing the uncompensated care that we need to give. And the Affordable Care Act may help in that regard as well, on the one hand. On the other hand, the compensation levels for many federally based medical programs are far less than what private insurance does. And the truth of the matter is most hospital systems, certainly private hospital systems generally, reduce the size of their Medicare, Medicaid, particularly Medicaid, in preference to private insurers, because the private insurers tend to reimburse at a more robust rate. And that more robust reimbursement to some degree subsidizes both the uncompensated care but also some of the Medicaid care as well. So to the extent we are taking larger and larger percentages, as we feel obligated to do, federally based reimbursed patients, it does not necessarily enhance dramatically our bottom line.
Yeah, you guys were among those people that would have been hit if the Medicare cuts that were part of the whole sequestration and end of the year debate had gone through. Yeah. Right?
Well, everybody would have. Every system would have. But us, we probably would have been hurt more. On the other hand, as I say, if the substitute is privately insured patients, you're actually better off. And that we feel a moral obligation on the Medicaid side to take a larger percentage than most institutions do. But it doesn't help the bottom line in that sense.
Michael Young is the president of the University of Washington, talking to us about, I guess what's coming forth in the next few months, right? You guys are playing poker. We see the first hand. You see the first card has been put down. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. This is Weekday.
Speaking of education issues, teachers at Seattle's Garfield High School are refusing to administer a standardized test. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld is looking into this, and we'll talk with her about that later this morning during the 10 o'clock hour. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Attention drivers, there's a big traffic backup on I-5 southbound at 85th. Traffic is moving and things are clearing up, but slowly. Again, that's I-5 heading south, backed up and slow from 85th Street all the way up through Shoreline.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Bach and Telemann on January 18th and 19th at Benaroya Hall, featuring Handel's Overture from the Occasional Oratorio, Telemann's Wassermusik, and J.S. Bach's Suite for Orchestra No. 4. Tickets at seattlesymphony.org.
According to the U.S. Department of Justice, in the year 2011, nearly half the inmates in federal prison were serving time for drug offenses. Washington State recently legalized marijuana, but what about heroin, crack, and meth? Some folks think we should legalize those as well. What do you think? Should we legalize all drugs? Why or why not? We'll be talking about that this afternoon at 12:20, and we'd love to get your thoughts right now. Give us a call, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. We're contemplating the legalization of all drugs this afternoon at 12:20. It's 30 degrees in Seattle, mostly clear sky. Forecast says it's going to be sunny all day with a high of 39. We'll get a more detailed weekend forecast from Washington State climatologist Nick Bond in about 20 minutes.
Oh, it must be football season and playoffs if we're playing that music. Seahawks in Atlanta. Art Thiel, who is, I'm calling you the dean of journalists in the sports racket in the Seattle area right now. Co-founder and columnist for Sports Press Northwest. He writes that, where else do you write? Do you write at Crosscut?
I contribute video and stories to Crosscut as well.
And you are on KPLU every
Friday and Saturday morning.
So you're competing with yourself. Oh, you've already been on, so you've already competed with yourself.
Yeah, that's true. But I consider it a very friendly competition.
As do I.
Yes.
Akin to what will happen between Seattle and Atlanta.
Well, I don't know that that's going to be so friendly.
So who are we looking at here when these two teams go into combat? Who are the which are the special teams? Which are the coverage units that you're most concerned about?
I'm concerned about my coverage unit. I'm going to Atlanta in a whirlwind 48-hour trip, and if I can pull that off, you know, then I don't care what happens in the football field. But actually, the interesting thing about this is it's two forlorn franchises. Both the Falcons have been around since 1966, and the Seahawks since 1976, and they've each made one Super Bowl appearance, and they've lost that Super Bowl appearance. So there is a lot of want to in the community surrounding the football teams as far as getting back to the Super Bowl and finally pulling it off, because really lots of teams win Super Bowls these days, and there's no reason to have these two left out, except they have such a woeful history of failure in the clutch. The Seahawks this time finally seem to have both the brains and the guts to pull through. Whether it happens this week, this is a tough call this weekend, because I think Atlanta is the weakest 13-3 team I've seen in a while. But they're also home, and they've got talent where Seattle doesn't, which is a wide receiver and tight end. And that could be the difference maker.
See, the Sports Illustrated said that they were gonna beat the Falcons. That was their prediction. But then they'd get steamrolled by the Green Bay Packers.
Well, yeah, the Green Bay Packers, you may recall from a Monday night game in September here in Seattle,
Yeah. Are
really itching to play the Seahawks again. And that would be kind of a fun matchup. It would be at Lambeau Field, and the Seahawks are 0-2 there in the playoffs. A very difficult place to win, especially with the rage after that Monday night loss and the Golden Tate intercept down, as we call it. So I'm guessing that Seattle could prevail barely this weekend, but they're missing a key guy, their defensive end Chris Clemons, and they also hired a kicker off the couch, Ryan Longwell. So it's been this week has been a little unsettling for the Seahawks, even though they have quite a buzz coming off the Washington Redskins win. It's a chore of going back east is another drag too.
Yeah, that's what people are saying, right? The back-to-back flights. But what they have this great quarterback. Doesn't he offset the concerns about the receivers?
Well, that is the difference maker. Russell Wilson has just continued a steady arc up. I don't think I've ever seen a young athlete, with the possible exception of Ken Griffey Jr., burst on the Seattle scene and just go straight up. You know, you usually have to have some patience, and there's been a little bit of that, but every mistake he makes, he corrects and doesn't make them again. It's amazing.
Now, Art, Nate Silver, New York Times polling guru Nate Silver, who everybody has to bow to after the election, he's predicting a Super Bowl appearance for the Seahawks.
Well, there you go. You should be talking to him then. I'm not.
He's a numbers guy.
Yeah, I know. I followed his success, and you know, and what he was doing. He's a former baseball seam head.
Yeah,
that's where he got his start, because he is in the Bill James school of quantitative daily data analysis that has transformed baseball. The best way the public knows it is through Moneyball, what the Oakland A's did and made themselves movie heroes on top of it. And so it's the
never
same
hurts
principle.
To have Brad Pitt portray you.
Yeah, well, the movie coming out on my life is either Brad Pitt or Ernest Borgnine. We haven't figured out which. But the Seahawks have actually, and this is another remarkable thing, become national media darlings. That just does not happen with Seattle sports.
Yeah.
But Russell Wilson is a great story. Pete Carroll will answer a question. Pete Carroll does not have punctuation in his vocabulary. There are no periods. There are no commas. There are some exclamation points. But the man will answer your question until you have to tell him, Pete, I have to go now. Please shut up.
But does he say things, too? I mean, do you get more than to win a game, we have to move the ball down the field?
Yeah. I mean, Pete, he isn't the avuncular storyteller that Mike Holmgren was, but he does pass on information. Again, it's propagandized. He is a coach, after all. But there's enough there to build stories on, and you have to cut through the verbiage, but it's there. And so he's, I think, won over a lot of skeptics in Seattle because, of course, he coached and won 7 Pac-10 titles at bad old USC. So a lot of people here weren't going to give him any slack. So he's earned it, and he's got a good chance to at least take him to the NFC title game, and then there's Green Bay.
And there's Green Bay. Do you think that the coaching staff, Carroll and his sub-coaches, are they the key to this? I've been reading some things that say these guys have been very good at – they're very good communicators with their players.
Well, I think testament for that is that the defensive coordinator, Gus Bradley, and the offensive coordinator, Darrell Bevell, are now being sought by teams who have head coaching vacancies. And there are 8 of them in the 32-team NFL. There is nothing like the NFL and the pressure to win to churn a coaching staff. So I think both of those guys are competent. I think Bradley is probably a little further along in his ability to get a head coaching job. But as far as their relations with players, it's been great. I think there's a uniform respect and appreciation. And I think the relationship they have and the enthusiasm that both these guys do, which is a kind of a comes from Carroll, really works. Now, there are a lot of skeptics who say that rah-rah stuff doesn't work in the pro game. And I would say it's probably got a shorter shelf life, but it's got the Seahawks where they are now.
Art Thiel is co-founder, columnist for Sports Press Northwest, the dean of sports reporters and columnists. Well, if Steve Kelly steps down, you're definitely the dean then, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I guess we're going to I don't know if we're going to do a ceremony where, the sword touches both shoulders or something like that. But I wish my pal well in his future endeavors, and I understand why he would like to go. And I'm just thinking that the whole sports writing dodge is changing so fast that it takes a lot to keep up, and he may want to step out, and yeah. I understand that.
All right, I can't let you go without asking you 2 quick questions. First of all, Edgar Martinez placed 10th in voting for the Hall of Fame. His percentages are going down. Is he never going to get into the Hall of Fame?
Well, the odds are long because there's a bias against the designated hitter, which he was for a long time. I think it's a foolish bias because baseball has the position, and he filled it better than anyone. They have room for specialists because relief pitchers are specialists. So I don't believe that should be held against him. The only thing that they can argue is that his career was shorter than many in the Hall of Fame because he started basically regular full-time play at age 27. I think he deserves it because he did his position better than anybody in baseball history, and that's worth a Hall of Fame nomination to me.
And what do you know today about the rumors about the Maloofs maybe selling Sacramento Kings and it coming up to Seattle?
Well, I there's still not much more concrete about going on. I can tell you that the Maloofs make the Adams family look like the Cleaver family. and so you're dealing with some really strange people here who are apt to say one thing and do another and then reverse it the next day.
I like the rumor that said they were going to sell, but they still wanted to have a say in how the team was managed.
Right, yeah. And that's like, giving letting the Taliban dictate your church activities. I just don't think this is a good idea. And neither does Chris Hansen. That is not going to happen.
I do like that you compared football owners to the Taliban.
Well, yeah, I realize that's going to irk a lot of the people in the Taliban, but I think it's a fair comparison.
Fair enough. All right, Art, have an excellent flight.
Oh, boy. I'm sure there's a middle seat with my name on it.
I'm sure there is. Thanks a lot.
All right, guys. See ya.
Okay, see ya. Game 10 is the game is at 10 a.m. on Sunday at the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. Art Thiel is co-founder and columnist for Sports Press Northwest. Thinking about weather, Nick Bond is a Washington State climatologist. I guess they won't have to worry, Nick Bond, about weather in Georgia, because if it's the Georgia Dome, they must be playing inside.
Yeah, and it looks like the weather's going to be pretty good there. There's some rain headed that way, but I think even if they were outside, it'd be okay in pretty warm temperatures. Unlike around here, where, of course, we've got some pretty icy conditions out there.
Yeah. What do we make of that? Is there more to come?
Yes, a lot more to come. And so today, the patchy fog that's around will slowly dissipate in a mostly sunny afternoon, but it's going to be chilly, just upper 30s, maybe 40 at best. Cold again tonight with, depending how clear it is, there are some clouds, upper-level clouds coming in that might help keep the temperatures up, but still looks like it well into the 20s in a lot of spots. Saturday, more of the same, patchy freezing fog in the morning, and Sunday, the same thing. There's about a 10% chance of a flurry or two late Saturday into Sunday, but not really a big chance. And so this pattern we're in through next week.
Now, so will it be overcast when it's not flurrying, or will it be sunny?
Mostly sunny afternoons once you get the fog out of the way. And there's some places where that fog lingers, other places where it's not much of an issue. But definitely a lot of black ice around. And what we're really looking at is some air stagnation next week. We had a brief period of this around the first of the year, but this looks like a worse event. And maybe a little chance of relief at the end of the week, but then we snap right back into the pattern. So if you really like polluted air and higher home heating bills, it looks like your wishes will come true.
That's what I like. I know that for sure. You've been looking at these the data that came out of NOAA's National Climatic Data Center about how 2012 was the warmest year on record by a pretty large margin. But what did that mean for Washington State?
Yeah, we didn't really join the party there. For the country as a whole, it was by far the warmest year on record, and many 19 states had their warmest year on record. But we were just only about 0.7 degrees Fahrenheit greater than the long-term mean. And in the Puget Sound region, it was almost identical to the long-term mean. And so we just basically weren't as hot in a relative sense as the rest of the country. And so, of course, the interesting question is, why were we spared?
It's usually the ocean, isn't it?
Well, that's part of it. The Pacific Ocean is a huge reservoir for heat. And so it both the observations and climate models we have show it's being slower to warm up the continental areas. But a bigger reason is that we're in the cold phase of a climate pattern with these really slow cycles in it called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or PDO. And being in a cool phase is good for snowpacks. It actually, salmon survival is higher, and there's some benefits from it. We were in a warm phase in the 1990s and early 2000s. And we're liable to switch back into such a warm phase, but we have no real good idea when that's going to happen.
All right. Well, we can enjoy the cold, polluted weather for the next few days then.
Yeah, and maybe longer. So.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He joins us to give us some weather information and the forecast every Friday. And now.
This is the
sound of the week.
The sound of the week.
This is just a little taste of summer for you with all this cold weather. It's the sound of bees getting a little angry that listener Tim recorded last summer when he was inspecting his beehives They were just going about their business when he swept a large amount off of a B frame. We'll have to match that with the amazing sound we had yesterday of the ice hitting that frozen lake. There's winter and summer in a sound. What interesting sounds are you hearing? Please share them with us. Record 30 seconds. Send it to us weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. We'll talk about the news of this past week and what predictions we make for, you know, the Seahawks. That's all coming up on Weekday.
On the drive from Solution to Surface, in my old...
The Centers for Disease Control is saying the flu has reached epidemic levels in the U.S. More about that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Hi, this is Lakshmi Singh. Renewing members are some of KUOW and NPR's most important sources of support. If you recently received a renewal notice, please mail it back or renew online at...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.